Recently, the International Crisis Group put out an insightful report about radicalism in Central Asia. The report carries several interesting points, such as more Central Asians are joining foreign militants, and they are doing it purely with religious convictions, motivations. In one point, the report also mentions that Central Asian militants are more available or accessible for foreign militants than those of Pakistan or Afghanistan-based militants. Again, paper also mentions various social elements triggering this development. Today, over the upcoming 30 minutes, we will discuss the subject and findings of the paper with the authors of the report. Taking part in the discussion are Dirde Tenan, the Crisis Group is Central Asia Program Director, Noah Bonsi, the Crisis Group is Syria Program Officer, who is joining us from Jordan, as I said, my colleague Joanna Parashok, who is following Islamic State's activity through her blog on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website called Under the Black Flag. Also, my colleague Bruce Panier is with me, who runs Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Thank you and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the show. Dirde, let's start with you. First of all, take us through some of the main findings of the paper that you just put out.
I think one of our main findings was that, contrary to a lot of reports that you would read in the Russian press, money or financial gain is not the main motivation why Central Asians leave. They have a genuine ideological and religious commitment to the idea of a caliphate and to the Islamic State. We've learned that the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, which many people to a degree wrote off in recent years, has been reinvigorated by Islamic State. Whilst the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan has not pledged allegiance to Islamic State, they have certainly profited somewhat from this, from the interest in what is happening in Syria. And we mean in that in terms of fundraising and also the radicalization that is happening as a result of people watching what is going on in the Middle East. The security services in Central Asia are simply not equipped to track or to monitor or to counteract the radicalization that is going on. And we feel that we've heard that Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan will certainly operate what was described to us as a zero-tolerance approach to returning fighters. But that actually is bad news for Kyrgyzstan, because Kyrgyzstan is a more open society, and people who intend to return to Central Asia will more likely come back to Kyrgyzstan because they can re-enter the country and will not be surveilled in a way that they would be in Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan. But also, an important thread going through our briefing is the radicalization of women. And that, I think, is a very important point and feeds back into the idea that it is not a caricature of a jihadi who wants to go to Syria and to support Islamic State. It is people who have genuine religious ideals, and they believe they are part of a big project that is not just about taking up arms or being a combatant in the classic sense. And that appeals very much to women and families and to a very diverse cross-section of society in Central Asia, not just semi-literate males aged 16 to 25, and that's a real problem.
And Dirde, it's a quite scary picture to say that Central Asians are a growing source of recruitment for foreign militants, as your report mentions, and they are also joining militancy, as just you said, with the religious convictions, and also women are among them, among those groups. I just don't like to dominate the discussion. It's an open floor. If you have any question, if you want to add some comments to what we are talking about, but just there was one point I wanted to raise here. In the report, it also says like there are 2,000 to 4,000 people from Central Asia in Syria fighting with the Islamic State. How did you come up with this number, Dirde?
We spoke widely to security sources, including very local security forces on the ground, right up to the ministerial level across Central Asia and also with Central Asia's regional partners. 2,000, we feel, is an accurate or in the correct ballpark. 4,000 was mentioned to us, but we feel that would definitely be at the upper limits of the number of Central Asians there. Well, the problem here is that it is very difficult for anybody to come up with an accurate figure because they are not able to track this in a precise way. And that's one of the problems for the Central Asian states in terms of the security conundrum that it poses. How do you let's say, for the sake of argument, that most people will enter Syria via Turkey. All the Central Asian states, bar Uzbekistan, have a visa-free regime with Turkey. How do you tell the difference between somebody who's going to work, who's somebody who's going for a holiday, or for somebody who is going to Turkey with the intention of travelling on to Syria? The region's international partners, and I would include Europe and Russia and organisations like the OSCE, now would be the right time to start really assisting the Central Asian security forces to monitor better radicalisation and the movement of people in and out of the region.
Can I just jump in with a question?
Sure, please.
There's two questions for Deirdre. One, your report mentions that your figures are based on from the last 3 years. You estimate that people came in. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, my main question is there any way of knowing of this 2,000 to 4,000 who have come in the last 3 years, how many could actually be considered combatants? I mean, you've mentioned the fact that a lot of women have gone over there, and that we know that families have gone over there. So if we take the low figure of 2,000, is there any way we can put roughly a percentage of how many of those people, of these 2,000, actually have guns in their hands and go out, and how many are drivers, support people, things like that? Because it does make a little bit of a difference. You would figure that you can rehabilitate someone who was a driver for a militant a lot easier than you can rehabilitate someone who has participated in combat out there.
That's a fair question, but that type of analysis is just not available. So we can't break it down by numbers. But in terms of what you were saying about people who go out there and they find themselves in some sort of support role, we have heard anecdotally of young men who have left who wanted to take up a proper combatant role but found themselves sidelined into doing things like driving and cooking and having a much lesser role than they expected.
I think Noah Bonsi might have some idea about what those Central Asians are doing in Syria.
Well, you know, I agree with Deirdre that it's difficult. We don't have good data in terms of where people are assigned or how it breaks down in terms of tasking. The more general point I would make is that, you know, whether we're speaking of Central Asians or foreign fighters in general, that ISIS has been very effective in addressing some of the problems it has with its own reputation locally, especially in Syria, as compared to Iraq. In Syria, its reputation within Syrian communities is quite negative. ISIS now has extremely poor relations with other armed groups opposing the Syrian regime throughout the country. And the fact that ISIS is able to continue to generate the kind of positive image among potential recruits in Central Asia and otherwise helps them to fill all kinds of manpower gaps or what would otherwise be manpower gaps, whether we're speaking about combatants or people in supporting roles.
I mean, that was always questioned. I mean, I don't like to take the discussion out to somewhere else. I mean, when we talk about this, how the IS attracting Central Asian militants, there was a report, Giovanna, you just wrote, I think, last week, citing to Bishkek-based analyst that IS has allocated like $17 million to destabilize Central Asia. And based on what the Deirdre and Noah was talking about, how to read that statement, whether that fits here into this discussion?
I think that statement was actually, it's part of a growing sense of fear that we're seeing in Central Asia about the threat of blowback from militants who are fighting in Syria and Iraq and then who come back. So I'm not too sure that there's any evidence to actually back up the fact that ISIS is actually allocating money for jihad outside of Syria and Iraq. I think it's more actually not doing that. It's more concentrating on developing its fighting capacity and taking over land and managing the land that it's taken over within Syria and Iraq. So, and in terms of blowback, an organized fashion like that, I'm not sure that's something that is actually, it's not something that we're seeing. I think the threat of blowback is different. It's just people who are already radicalized come home and they decide to commit attacks outside of a framework that's being funded right now, as far as we can see.
Noah, you just mentioned that the impression of IS militants among Syrian community is not good, and since Central Asians are included in that IS, if they are coming to Syria with the intention of jihad or fighting with the militants, I mean, why they are coming to Syria? I mean, why don't go to Afghanistan or Pakistan where their Central Asian militants are already fighting there?
Right, and that's an excellent question. And I think it really gets to the heart of just how intense and how public, how visible this conflict in Syria has become. I mean, the fact that, in particular, the brutality of the regime's military approach, the use of such the indiscriminate tactics and collective punishment are such a huge component of the regime's military strategy, and the results, the casualties, especially among civilians, resulting from that strategy, mm-hmm. Are broadcast around the world on YouTube, and in a way that really we haven't seen. I don't know that we have seen this depth and breadth of violence against civilians so visible. At least not in the conflict relevant to jihadis. So it really has developed an emotional appeal, and it gets to the point of why it's so difficult to address the jihadi problem, the ISIS problem in general, so long as the Syrian conflict and the Iraqi conflict rage on, so long as the government tactics remain as destructive as they are. People will continue to go fight because they want to join in what they view as a legitimate resistance against these oppressive regimes. And the fact that, they, as people sympathizing with jihadis, of course view jihadi groups, ISIS first and foremost, as the natural potential means of joining into that fight.
Right.
If I could add there, we actually did ask that question as we were doing our research, and two issues came up. One is it is simply easier to get to Turkey than it is to get to Afghanistan or Pakistan from Central Asia. And also, in terms of the sort of media presence of Islamic State, a lot of their forums, a lot of the discussion happens in either the local languages of Central Asia, but often in Russian, and therefore it's accessible in a way that Afghanistan and Pakistan was never beforehand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can just add to that, actually, that's a really, really good point, because in terms of my monitoring of social media, I'm seeing there's a lot of discussions between people who are in Syria with Islamic State or other groups, and maybe people who want to join, and it's on a very colloquial one-on-one level. So it's very easy to access someone who's in Syria, and it's very easy to ask them questions about what life is like there.
Another interesting point in the report was most of those militants who are coming to Syria to fight with the IS group from Central Asia are ethnic Uzbeks, either from Uzbekistan or Kyrgyzstan or Tajikistan, I mean ethnic groups in those two countries. How to read this point?
I mean, that was a consistent finding across the board. Whoever we spoke to, everybody told us that they felt that the largest number were ethnic Uzbeks. But there was one thing I'd really like to point out here. Any attempt by other Central Asian governments to paint this exclusively as an ethnic Uzbek problem is not accurate either. There are Kyrgyz going, there are Tajiks going, there are Kazakhs going, there are Turkmen as well. So in somewhere like Kyrgyzstan, it would be a mistake for the Kyrgyz government to say it's an ethnic Uzbek problem. The answers may be simply demographics. Uzbekistan is the most populous country in the region. There are simply more Uzbeks in Central Asia than there are anyone else. But also, some people we spoke to in Istanbul suggested that young men who are frustrated by their lack of political voice in Uzbekistan and who would have violent tendencies are for the moment not engaging with Uzbekistan or Karimov's regime as a challenge, but going to Syria instead.
Bruce Panier, obviously you are our main person who has a very deep experience about following with all the sort of Central Asian militants abroad and inside of the country. Is it surprising for you to see that most of those militants are Uzbeks, ethnic Uzbeks?
No. And, you know, I mean, I would just follow up on Deirdre's point that I don't find this just demographically. The number of ethnic Uzbeks in Central Asia has got to be somewhere around 40%. You know, if you consider all the Uzbeks that are living in southern Kazakhstan and northern Tajikistan and in southern Kyrgyzstan, plus the ones in Uzbekistan, it just simply shakes out that percentage-wise, it's probably the same as or pretty close as it would be to Kyrgyz or Tajiks, but just simply because there's more Uzbeks, you know, and Russian, the number of migrant laborers in Russia is a good example for this, too. Most of the migrant laborers in Central Asia come are Uzbek, anyway, and come from Uzbekistan. And that just reflects the fact that there's more Uzbeks than there are anybody else. So I don't find that incredibly surprising that there's more of them. You know, but to continue that a little bit, I would say that the repressive government that they have in Uzbekistan certainly contributes to a lot of the Uzbeks from Uzbekistan going to this place, and they've been going south of the border into Afghanistan and Pakistan for, you know, 15 years for the same reason. So I would say that possibly the incentive for an ethnic Uzbek from Uzbekistan to go to Syria is a little bit higher than it would be for some of the other peoples, Tajiks in Tajikistan, Kyrgyz in Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhs in Kazakhstan, simply because they know that the situation at home is so grim and dire. They have no opportunity to express their opinion, their voice, you know. And when they do, if they do try to do that, and this has been repeated historically for the last, you know, more than 20 years, chances are you're going to go to jail. And not only that, but then your relatives. I mean, in some ways, and this is addressed in the International Crisis Group report, too. In some ways, the Central Asian governments are their own worst enemies. They tend to view problems like radicalism as something that needs to be addressed with a hammer. And so they come after these people and they jail them, and then they jail their relatives, and they end up just sending waves of people who are friends and relatives and are not jailed or detained out of the country to join these fringe elements. It's happened, you know, Uzbekistan again, it's happened repeatedly. Bombings in Tashkent in 1999, you know, you have a wave of people who end up in the mountains of eastern Tajikistan and then make their way even into northern Afghanistan. And you know, then again in 2004, there were attacks, you know, in Bukhara and Tashkent, and they initiated the same, government initiated the same crackdown. They actually created more recruits who again went down into these areas. You know, I mean, it's a shame that the policy is just so heavy-handed, because it actually plays into the favor of some of these groups. You know, an Uzbek that's already become radicalized understands that he has no future at home, and then he's forced to go into some of these other places, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Iraq. You know, so I'm not surprised. We, you know, and it's definitely it's a good point to bring up, is that, you know, well, if the country that you live in is a little bit more liberal and you have some opportunity to move politically, you might be less inclined to join some of these groups. But if you're an Uzbek from Uzbekistan, you have very, very few options.
In this case, Bruce, in terms of repression in the country, in their home countries, like Kyrgyzstan is relatively better than compared to Uzbekistan, for instance. And then why people are going out from Kyrgyzstan to join these kind of groups outside?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that's really puzzled me, is because prior to this, and of course, you know, Deirdre and other people have made the point that a lot of the people from Kyrgyzstan who are joining the group are actually ethnic Uzbeks, and a lot of them came from the south. And we know about the ethnic unrest there in 2010, so that was probably one of the reasons they went. Now, why an ethnic Kyrgyz or an ethnic Kazakh would go has kind of puzzled me, because these two peoples have not contributed very much to Afghanistan and Pakistan, for instance. You don't find very many Kyrgyz, ethnic Kyrgyz or ethnic Kazakhs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, of course, we know that the numbers are low. We're talking about hundreds of ethnic Kyrgyz and Kazakhs together. That would be the most. But why they're attracted to go to Syria and Iraq is something that I've been at least trying to figure out and keep an eye on. you know, I don't know. In Kyrgyzstan, perhaps the economic situation. We know that also from Kazakhstan, for the most part, the people that are coming, that are ethnic Kazakhs that go there, are from the West. And the West has a little bit shakier situation with some of these groups, Salafis, people like that, who have taken up homes there or have taken on the religion in that part of the country. But it's still kind of, like I said, it's interesting for me. I can understand why the Turkmen would go if they were in Turkey and they could get recruited because of the nature of their government back home. I can understand why the Uzbeks would do it. To some extent, even why the Tajiks would do it, because the Tajiks have such a high publicized closure of mosques and things like that in their country. Their acts of the Tajik government against the establishment of Islam are publicized all the time, so you can see it's unfair. But the Kyrgyz and Kazakhs are kind of a mystery to me. I'm trying to figure out, and we know that those are the two places where we've had entire villages, like, you know, or at least significant segments of villages pick up and leave. And so I'm, you know, like I said, I wish I had an answer for that. You know, no one has been very successful in attracting Kyrgyz and Kazakhs to their jihadist movements until this. And again, I would still, you know, I would want to make really clear that we're talking about a very, very small number here compared to how many people in the country. But for what it's worth, it's interesting that they have actually got some message that seems to resonate with some of the people in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan about come to Syria, come to Iraq and wage jihad.
Yeah, if I could, when I think about this, I think it brings us back to what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, which is the strength of Islamic State's own brand appeal. That's why and how they are able to attract Kyrgyz and Kazakhs when we would not normally expect these people to want to fight a jihad. The answer lies not completely, but very strongly in ISIS' ability to put itself out as the premier jihadi group.
Then why this strength, you mentioned this strength of this PR thing, why this strength is not equally effective in Central Asia, like from Turkmenistan? We don't know any number. You did mention in your report that there are Turkmens, but we don't know what number we are talking about. But obviously we think that's not comparable with any other group of militants that are going from Central Asia to Syria. But why it's not effective then in Turkmenistan?
I guess that might have something to do with the relative access to social media, which would be completely different between Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan, for example.
When you mentioned Turkmens are taking part in that Syrian war, what number we are talking about from Turkmenistan?
We've heard between 300 and 400. The consensus seems to be that it is safe to say that from Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan, we are talking numbers of 300 to 400.
From each of those countries, right?
Yes.
Joanna, does your information support this idea of people from Turkmenistan fighting in Syria?
I've seen evidence of Turkmen Jamaats, like fighting groups, but it's been very small. They haven't really publicized themselves as much as the other groups, as much as the Kazakhs, for example, which we see, and the Uzbek groups who've got more of a social media presence. So it's hard to tell, actually.
Bruce, what is your thinking in this line? I mean, why we don't know much about Turkmens in Syria?
Well, that is a good question. I mean, you know, because ironically, the first Central Asian peoples that I ever remember showing up there were those Turkmen that they caught and put on video, and that was almost, you know, that's getting to be almost 2 years ago. The Syrian government had caught them and put them up there, and they claimed they were from Turkmenistan. You know, I think part of it is that and this is probably a very little part of it, but we know about the migrant laborers that go to Russia and get radicalized. But not that many migrant laborers come from Turkmenistan and go to Russia, at least not stuff I see from the Russian Federal Migration Service. But a lot do go to Turkey, and this is another big question I have here, too, is, you know, we know a lot of the radicalization happens in mosques in Russia, but there's a lot of migrant laborers, and this is especially true in the Turkmen case, that are working in Turkey. And that seems to be in the Turkmen case where a lot of these people become radicalized or are lured into Syria. They're right there anyway, but they're actually working in Turkey and going to mosques in Turkey. And that's where this seems to happen to them. So I think you don't hear a lot as much about it because the Turkish government, at least, you know, and I can't read Turkish, but the media that's in English and stuff, doesn't really cover that much about the Central Asians that are fighting in Syria and maybe for the reasons that the government doesn't want people to know that everyone's coming through Turkey to get into Syria, although that's pretty obvious. So they don't cover that. But that's as far as I can tell, that seems to be where the Turkmen come from. And I guess there's just not much media coverage in Turkey about ethnic Turkmen that decide to, pack up and go south of the border. So that would be the only thing I can think of. I mean, I would agree 100% that as far as Turkmen inside Turkmenistan, I don't have to tell you that the access to the internet is so limited. And of course, state media is the only media there, and they're not going to, I don't think they even bring this subject up, in papers or on TV. So if you were a Turkmen living in Turkmenistan, you might not even know or barely know that there's a conflict in Syria. So in the case of the Turkmen, I think that's what's happening. So we really don't know. We don't have a good figure for that. But like I said, for what it's worth, they were the first Central Asian people that I ever remember anyone talking about in Syria were Turkmen.
And it's already half an hour. I promised to round up this discussion in 30 minutes. But I got one more important question to ask, Dirda, if you allow me. Central Asia is becoming an increasing source for militants. Okay. They are more easy to recruit. That's also another point. And they are very committed fighters. So what does it say in terms of the challenges that Central Asian states are facing from this reality?
I think you can break it into two parts. Yeah. One we can see, and that is that life in Central Asia has not delivered in many ways to people who have actually seen their standards of living fall and their opportunities narrow since the fall of the Soviet Union, and they are looking for alternatives. That is, for me it's a big issue. What does Central Asia have to offer a young person who wants to express themselves politically, who wants to have economic opportunities in their own region without having to move to Russia to get a job? These are really, very, very basic questions for Central Asian governments, and yet they are important because they feed into the larger questions about why people get radicalized. We don't see that they are being properly addressed in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan, and certainly in certain regions of Kazakhstan. There is a huge gap between Almaty and Astana and the rest of Kazakhstan. The other question that we look at is more of sort of a present tense one, or one for the near future. Will people who have experience of Syria come back to Central Asia and want to replicate what has happened there? Now, in the briefing, we argue that a lot of the combatants they will not come back because they will be killed in Syria. But there is a change of tempo, there is a change of tone in Central Asia, which, as Bruce said earlier, I think, in some ways the Central Asian governments, they are a danger to themselves. They love to find a third force or an external issue that threatens the region, but yet they are reluctant to look at their own domestic problems, be that the ability of their security services, the corruption that alienates people, the lack of rule of law, that all contributes to this bigger picture in Central Asia and why people become radicalized.
Nova and Joanna Parashuk, you might be the best person to ask this question. I mean, you study those people who are fighting in Syria, and obviously you study Central Asian militants fighting in Syria. Whether they go back, whether they stay in outside of the country, what kind of challenge that reality poses to Central Asian governments? Nova, if you like, you can start, and later, Joanna, feel free to continue.
Well, I think there's definitely a better place than I to talk about potential ramifications. The one thing I would just emphasize here is a point that was mentioned earlier, that the wars in Iraq and Syria are continuing, the underlying dynamics are not improving. And so I think that whatever problems, I think that for most countries, and I'm not as familiar with Central Asia specifically, the continuing attraction of the two continuing wars will mean that the overall flow of fighters remains in the direction of the conflicts themselves rather than blow back at this stage.
Joanna?
I would tend to agree with that, actually. And I'd also like to bring back Deirdre's point from earlier, which is that actually a lot of these people are actually going to be killed in Syria and Iraq, so they're not going to come home. But there's another kind of element to this, which is the fact that it's not just Central Asian men and women that we're seeing in Syria, it's actually children as well. There's been a couple of videos lately who are showing children being trained as militants, yeah. And even one video that seemed to show a child actually executing two men. So I think that's also something to bear in mind. You know, if people do come back and these children come with them, I mean, that's also... I'm not too sure of how great a threat it is because we're not talking very big numbers, but I think it's also something that we need to bear in mind.
If Bruce, I come back to you, my question has a two-leg, actually. One, these realities that I just mentioned, that the fact that Central Asia is becoming an increasing source for militants and they are easy to recruit and also committed fighters. First, what challenge does this reality pose to Central Asia? And the second leg of this question is, what has to happen to face this challenge?
Ooh, yes, that's a good question. You know, the attraction's definitely there. I think every one of the panelists has been hitting on the fact that the opportunities to advance yourself socially or economically in Central Asia are extremely limited. So you're facing a problem there. You know, that people just don't think, you know, to kind of take this one point further, I've talked to people in Central Asia who said, you know, democracy's failed in Central Asia. You know, and in a couple different countries, because what the governments practice and call democracy is, of course, not democracy, but that's all the Central Asian people have been exposed to. So they say it's failed. And they agree, you know, a lot of them think that the system has failed and has to be replaced with something else. And we know that secular political opposition is stepped on really hard all the time in most of the countries. So your option has become this Islamic factor. Now you have to worry about being too pious. It's not even a question of being a radical. It's a question of having people say, "Guy, he goes and prays, you know, five times, or he goes and prays every day, and then he goes to namaz and everything." And already you're held in suspicion. And they have to kind of lose. The governments of the region have to lose that sense that piety equals radicalism. You know, and of course you'd like to see them develop some social programs and stuff that, you know, something that would make the society more fair and give people hope that tomorrow might actually be better than today. You know, whereas now the view is they just hope that tomorrow isn't any worse than today. You know, so that would be something that they'd have to work on too. So you're going to have to ease the grip on Islam in the region and accept the fact that it's going to be part of the societies out there. It doesn't necessarily have to be a threat. You can't, you know, I understand that it's probably the biggest unifying factor in Central Asia, but it's not a threat in itself. You know, it's the people that politicize it for their own reasons. And again, because there's no secular political parties, this is one of the only outlets that's left with people. Now, what you do about all the people that have gone outside the country, you know, I mean, we've been talking about Syria and Iraq, and we've mentioned Afghanistan and Pakistan, but, you know, Joanna will remember that I mentioned before, we got a lot of Uzbeks in Yemen. You know, I mean, they're showing up in a lot of different places for, you know, what they believe are legitimate causes. They're purely Islamic. They would rather serve God than serve man, which is a very general way of putting it and wrapping it up. But, you know, that's kind of tough to beat, you know. And again, getting back to the point that will they be able to, after all this experience, will they be able to topple the Central Asian governments? Well, no, none of them, really, because they just don't have the numbers. They don't have the support. They don't have the finances. But it doesn't take much to stir up trouble in Uzbekistan, and we've mentioned this too. One or two bombings in a Central Asian country will draw such a harsh response from the government that you end up getting more recruits in the end.
Yeah.
You know, the Uzbek government will jail thousands of people, and you'll get thousands of recruits, you know, that will leave the country and go and join these kind of groups. So it's kind of this vicious cycle that we get into.
My colleague Joanna Parashok and Bruce Panier and Dirda Tenan, Noah Bonsi from International Crisis Group, thank you very much for being a part of the discussion. It has been a fascinating half an hour. I'm grateful for you being available to take part in the show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Malin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.